From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A street hustler turns into a revolutionary in the 1971 film Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. The success of that low-budget independent film led the way for black action films like Shaft and Superfly. Sweetback was written and directed by Melvin Van Peebles, who also starred in it. Now his son, Mario Van Peebles, has written and directed the new movie Badass about the making of Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Mario stars as his father, Melvin. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Mario Van Peebles. He also wrote and directed New Jack City and played the part of Malcolm X in Ali. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Spider-Man 2. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Saddam Hussein appeared before a judge in Baghdad today and heard charges read out against him. He dismissed the proceedings as theater orchestrated by President Bush. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Baghdad.
Saddam looked tidier today than he did when he was pulled from his hideout in December. He arrived at the court in chains, but those were soon removed. An Iraqi judge read 7 broad charges against him, including using chemical weapons against the Kurds and invading Kuwait. Saddam refused to sign any until he had a lawyer. Some Iraqis watching court footage on TV expressed delight, others regret. Salim Chalabi, head of the special tribunal organized to try Saddam, says this was an important step in the process.
I think the Iraqis have generally felt that this was not going to happen, and it happened. So I think the psychological barrier has been broken.
Saddam's trial isn't expected to start until next year at the earliest. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
Jordan's King Abdullah said today that he's prepared to send troops to Iraq if the interim Iraqi government requests them. Abdullah would be the first Arab leader to send troops to Iraq. He refused to do so during the Iraq War. The king told the BBC that he changed his mind because he believes that all the countries in the region will pay the price if Iraq's interim government should fail. Connecticut's new governor, Jody Rell, is promising to bring honor and integrity to state government following the resignation of Governor John Rowland in the midst of a corruption scandal. Ebong Udama reports from member station WSHU.
Speaking at her swearing-in ceremony on the steps of the state capitol in Hartford, Rell acknowledged that Connecticut has been plagued by corruption. She pledged to turn this around by making ethics her first priority. She announced that she's appointed an ethics czar to her cabinet.
A person who will report directly to me, who will work with enforcement agencies on matters involving corruption, unethical practices, or alleged abuses of public authority.
Rell, a 58-year-old Republican, was Rowland's lieutenant governor. 2 polls released this week find that most Connecticut voters don't know much about Rell, but they believe she'll be an effective governor. For NPR News, I'm Ebong Udama in Hartford.
Former Senator John Danforth was sworn in today as the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas administered the oath of office to the Missouri Republican. Danforth replaces John Negroponte, who's now the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Danforth formerly served as President Bush's special envoy to Sudan. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 101 points, or nearly 1%, to close at 10,334. The Nasdaq was down 32 to 2015. This is NPR News. A first-ever survey of judges who handle foster care cases says that children remain stuck in foster care far longer than they need to because of gaps in the system that serves them. The survey was released today by a public education project called Fostering Results. NPR's Libby Lewis reports.
More than 2,200 judges responded to the survey. Some of those judges said they themselves lack the training they need. Nancy Salyers is a retired judge and co-director of Fostering Results.
One of the judges actually commented that the amount of training that he had before he started hearing these cases was unconscionable.
Salyer says their decisions can have an effect on children for the rest of their lives.
Judges who don't get training and just have to learn as quickly as possible, the common phrase, and this is pretty crass, when in doubt, yank them out.
the judges also raised some familiar themes that trap children: overcrowded court dockets and poorly trained caseworkers. Libby Lewis, NPR News, Washington.
The FBI is urging law enforcement officials to be extra watchful for possible terrorist activity over the 4th of July holiday. The Bureau said it had no specific credible threat of a terrorist attack over the weekend, but added that Al-Qaeda has shown an ongoing interest in staging an attack in the U.S. It said possible targets could include transportation infrastructure such as subways, bridges, and tunnels, or energy sites from gas stations and refineries to power plants. The FBI's weekly bulletin to law enforcement agencies warned officials to look out for terrorist surveillance of possible targets. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is actor and director Mario Van Peebles. He made his directorial debut with the 1991 movie New Jack City, in which he also co-starred. He also directed and starred in The Western Posse, played Malcolm X in the film Ali, and directed Panther, a film about the Black Panther Party. Van Peebles made his movie debut when he was a boy, playing a small role in the 1971 film Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Sweetback was written and directed by Mario's father, Melvin Van Peebles, who also starred in it. This low-budget independent film with an African-American hero was a big success and proved to Hollywood that there was a market for Black action films. Mario Van Peebles' new film, Badass, is about the making of his father's film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Mario wrote and directed Badass and plays his father. Here's Mario as his father, Melvin, in a scene from the film. Melvin's agent is trying to negotiate a three-picture deal with a studio. The studio wants a follow-up to his film Watermelon Man. They don't want to have anything to do with Sweetback. The agent is played by Saul Rubinek.
This idea I got is kind of like a ghetto western. In fact, ghetto the brother western. Even wears like a black kind of cowboy hat.
Yeah.
And dig this, man. At the end of the movie, when he gets away, words come blazing across the screen. Badass nigga's gonna come back and collect some dues.
What, have you lost your mind? Are you taking drugs now?
Listen to me. Melvin, listen to me. On Watermelon Man, your white lead is supposed to wake up from this nightmare where he's a black guy and turn back into being white again. You said, no, being black is not a nightmare, and you didn't shoot the ending the studio wanted. Who backed you 100%?
Me. So why are you doing this to me? I can't take this kind of inflammatory to a major studio. Nobody legitimate is going to talk badass. No one. You know how hard we worked to get here. Melvin, just do the comedy, okay? All right, look, they're coming here. Listen, you know what this is? You're terrified you're going to fail, so you're failing yourself. Nothing to do with being black or blue or green. You hear me? It's self-destruction. Hey, Marty. Alan. How you doing? So, listen.
Mario Van Peebles, welcome to Fresh Air. What do you consider to be the importance of your father's film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song?
What my dad did with Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song was make the first black power film. And so when Sweetback burst on the scene, suddenly all these folks who were feeling the same way coalesced behind it, and Sweetback made for way under $1 million, makes some $15 million when it was about $1 a ticket. So that'd be, Terry, that's about $150 million a day, if my math is correct. So it was a huge phenomenon, because after that, Hollywood, which has an Achilles pocketbook, saw Sweetback make all that money. They had a movie about a white detective. They changed it to a black detective immediately, and called that movie Shaft. And then after that came Superfly, and then the Foxy Browns, etc., and the quote-unquote era of soul cinema, or blaxploitation, depending on your take, was born.
So would you just, like, summarize the plot of Sweetback?
Yeah, Sweetback's Badass Song is basically about a flawed street hustler who turns into what the Panthers dubbed a revolutionary, that this is a guy who goes from this sort of bling-bling mentality and starts to go from the what about me getting paid to what about us as a people getting through. And the Panthers loved it because it was, like I said, about a street hustler who becomes a revolutionary. And a lot of the Panthers themselves were street brothers and sisters who got more of a political outlook. And that's why they endorsed Sweetback. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale made Sweetback required viewing for the Panther Party. But what they said about the subsequent films was often the subsequent films that followed and imitated the formula made being a cop hip, i.e. working for the status quo, or even being a drug dealer hip, which is even more counter-revolutionary. So that's loosely the story of Sweetback.
Now, why did you want to make a film about the making of the film?
Yeah, great. That's a good idea. Well, you know, it was an interesting process for me. Why did I make Badass? And I was on the set of Ali and being directed by Michael Mann. And we had these great sort of political discussions. And Michael is a real historian. And, of course, Ali is there himself. And I started to think about the notion, if Ali were, you know, one of the first athletes to use the ring, not just to box, but to stand for something, then Melvin Van Peebles was one of the first filmmakers to use the silver screen, not just to entertain us, but to stand for something, to say, we no longer want to be depicted as butlers and maids or as Uber Negroes trying to fit in and guess who's coming to dinner. That's fine. It's got its place. But there's also a place for folks, black folks in cinema that do live to the end, that do have a sexuality, that are empowered and are not just sort of dealing with the oppressor. And so I thought, no, I'll go see my dad. My dad's got a great book on the making of Sweetback, and he's got the book on the shelf. And, you know, so I go to see the old man, and my dad said, yeah, I love you. If you want the book, I don't want to get screwed on the deal. You have to option it and pay for it like everybody else. And if you play me or whoever plays me, don't make me too damn nice. And I wrote the script with Dennis Haggerty, and we sent it out, and as you saw in the movie Badass, I didn't sugarcoat him. He is who he is.
Now, you were 12 years old when your father was making Sweet Sweetback?
Yeah, 12 going on 13.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a small, famous or infamous part in Sweet Sweetback's Badass song. I want you to describe the scene that you're in.
Well, actually, I'm in two scenes.
One, you know the scene I want you to describe.
People tend to remember more than others. Yeah. I blew up a car where I did keep my afro. And the other scene is the beginning of the movie where I play, ironically, Sweetback as a kid. So I'm playing my dad's character as a kid, and now in Badass, I'm playing my dad as an adult. But in the Sweetback scene as a kid, you see how Sweetback gets his name. And Sweetback was an old sort of blues term about a guy that was good at making love. And so as a kid, he gets initiated with this prostitute in a brothel. And I play the kid in that scene. And then it turns into my dad playing Sweetback. I often tease him that I'd like another crack at the role now. But you know, at the time, I didn't want to. I didn't want to be working with him on the movie after a while. I thought my dad and I didn't always get along. I would never put my kids in a scene like this. So I have a lot of differences with him, and I still have differences with him. But I came to understand him differently as a man, you know, walking in those shoes.
Well, in 1990, I interviewed your father, and I asked him about why he cast you in that scene. And I want to play you that part of the interview. It'll just take a minute. So here it is, a 1990 interview with Melvin Van Peebles, who is the father of my guest, Mario Van Peebles.
Sweetback, the movie opens with a 10-year-old Sweetback finding a home for himself in a whorehouse and having his sexual initiation with a 40-year-old woman. And it's a fairly explicitly done scene. They're both nude. He's in between her legs. And this is your son in that role, your 10-year-old son. I was astonished when I found out it was your son. What made you decide to cast him in that part?
Well, one, he tends to look like me, being my
right.
son and all.
Yeah.
And what I always found very interesting was people saying, but it's your son. But every child is someone's son, and I wouldn't ask my son or myself to do anything that I wouldn't ask of anyone else's child. I don't have that differentiation of, well, it's mine, and therefore it cannot be.
Let me just ask you, how much did your son know about sex when that scene was shot? I mean, did he get what was happening?
Well, let me put it this way. He wanted a bicycle for Christmas, so he didn't have a lot of leverage. And I didn't ask him, actually. Well, he did say something rather funny, though. He said, Dad, is this going to be an X movie? I said, yes. He said, phew, oh, I don't want the kids at school to see me.
Okay, so that's Melvin Van Peebles, recorded in 1990. Mario, what did you think of his answer that he wouldn't have asked his son to do anything that he wouldn't have asked anyone else's son to do, and he wouldn't have asked anyone else's son to do something that he couldn't ask his own son to do?
You know what? I didn't enjoy it at all. I didn't want to be in that scene. I didn't want to have to give that lovely bike back. That bike had a banana seat. Yeah. And I didn't want to get my afro cut. Luckily, I got to keep my you know, afro intact. I wish I still had it today.
This is a flashback sequence, so your father wanted you to cut the afro and have shorter hair so that it would look time appropriate.
But I wound up getting to wear a skin wig. So
right.
I was saying at that time we had a lot of differences.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm. Now,
and I think I show that in the movie. I mean, we've continued to grow as people and as men, but pretty honest about it.
One of the things your father mentioned when I was talking to him is that you asked how the movie would be rated, and you were relieved when it was X, when he told you it would be X-rated because you didn't want your friends to see you nude in that scene. Did your friends see you in the scene?
A couple of them did, and then I got a lot of date calls.
Oh, really? So it worked in your favor.
Like I said, I wouldn't mind another shot now. He said, well, I'm not giving another shot. I had to fill in for you last time.
Now you were in the position, I mean, you not only like play your father in Badass, but you were in your father's position of having to cast a boy to play the role that your father made you play when he was making his film. So how did you cast for it? Who did you choose? And how explicit did you want to make your version of his scene?
Well, I thought I didn't want to make anyone do that scene twice. So in Badass, I just used the original footage of me as a kid in Sweetback during that scene. So the kid I cast wasn't going to have to do anything like that. And that's just something that I wanted to do. I'm not going to repeat, you know, do unto someone else what I didn't like done unto me. But I did want to show the scene because I thought it was a point in my life. And it just showed something interesting about Melvin that he was sort of like that great Santini-esque father, almost that which does not kill you in a Nietzsche-esque way makes you stronger. And if I bounce this basketball off your head a little bit, well, you'll be tough and you'll know how to deal. And, you know, so he has his whole philosophy. And, you know, I'm a filmmaker and I've benefited from him, you know, knocking down the doors he knocked down. Absolutely.
Did your father charge you a lot of money for rights to use the scene in your film?
That's a good question. This guy is a trip, man. So I go to my dad. I say, okay, now listen, I got the movie funded. So I go to see my old man because I wanted to put some clips of his film Sweetback in my film Badass. And he says, great. Yeah, just tell me the scenes you want and I'll put them up and you can pay for them. I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is product placement. People will see Badass and want to see Sweetback. What are you talking about? This is product placement. He goes, no, you got to pay for them just like anybody else. So sure enough, I wound up writing him a check. I think it was for $2,500 and giving it to him, which he promptly cashed. And then he turned around and said, by the way, I want to take you and all your Badass kids on vacation. And he wound up spending about $5,000 to take us on this lovely vacation on an island in Guana. And take my sister and her kids as well. So he's a funny dude because in one hand he's doing the business deal with his son and he's, you know, taking the money and in the other pocket he's putting twice as much back. But that's Melvin Van Movies.
My guest is screenwriter, director, and actor Mario Van Peebles. His new film is called Badass. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is screenwriter, director, and actor Mario Van Peebles. In his new film, Badass, he stars as his father, actor, writer, and director Melvin Van Peebles. Badass is about the making of Melvin's 1971 movie, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. I think the way you play your father in your movie, Badass, kind of walks the line between obsessively adhering to his artistic vision and being selfish, and walks the line between being confident and arrogant. I thought that seemed, not knowing him, to have a ring of truth to it. How did you see him when you were 12 and he was making the movie? Did you see him as confident or arrogant? Did you see him as selfish?
You know, I don't know that as 12 I analyzed it.
And when I say selfish, I mean because he was putting a lot of family kind of interests on the back burner to make this movie. He was losing money. He was totally obsessed. He was losing money.
Single vision, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, he's a driven cat. And, you know, there's that scene in Badass where he says to Big T, Big T is, the crew has spent a weekend in jail. And Big T, who's the big, you know, muscled sound man is really pissed by this. And my dad has that scene where he says, look, you know, this is bigger than you. I got all my stuff on the line and all my family stuff. This is a war. It's our war to take back our imagery. We'll not be butlers. We won't be shuffling. It's bigger than you. It's bigger than me. And if you don't know that, then quit. You know, and if you're going to say you're going to kick my ass, do it. And if I was afraid of you, I wouldn't be the kind of brother to get this thing done. And that's very much my pop. And he's still that way to this day. What he believes in, he stands for. And I respect that. And he made changes. I wouldn't have been able to get Badass done the same way. I mean, now, 30 years later, I could get a union crew that was multiracial, where there were women on the crew. There were Asians on the crew. My DP was a 63-year young Jewish brother. And my Asian set decorator and designer and the young sister with the fro who did the wardrobe. I could get, because my dad had broken the unions and made sure that these people could work. I directed a film called New Jack City in 1991, 90. And the guy that came to me who was my producer, Preston Holmes, said, you know how I got my job? I said, how? He said, because your dad was willing to get fired so that all of us could come on as crew. And he did get fired. He insisted we stay. And that's how I got my job. And so I look at the changes he made. And I'm like, wow, I don't know if I'd have the freedom I do now as a filmmaker had I not had, you know, this dad who was willing to pay the cost to be the godfather of soul cinema.
I know actors often feel that when they put on the costumes, you know, or the wardrobe for a movie, that they are transformed by those clothes. Now, in your case, you were wearing what I imagine were clothes very similar to what you remembered your father wearing when your father made Sweet Sweetback. So how did you feel in those clothes, saying the things you remembered your father saying and doing your best to become him? Can you just, like, talk about what that felt like?
Oh, to play your father, making a film that you remember him making, and you were on that set. I had some of the very same clothes that he wore. That sort of pimpy, crushed velvet, gold, obnoxious outfit, for example. I don't know where he got that outfit. That thing was horrendous. Anyway, I had them get me another outfit, make me an outfit like that. And we were shooting a scene in L.A. in the hood. And since it was an independent film and I only had 18 days to make the movie, I used my own truck. See, that was my camera vehicle. So I had my truck, and I had the DP stick the camera out the window. He hadn't been to the hood, so he was like, he's a little nervous. He's sticking the camera out the window. I said, okay, here's the deal. We don't have permits for any of this. I'm going to walk on the other side of the street. And when I signal you, I'm going to run through the ghetto. And you photograph me, but we'll only get one shot at it because the second time I run through, they're going to recognize me. So I got on the Mac Pimp Daddy suit. I got the mustache just like Dad. And I signal him. He starts driving the truck. They're shooting out the window. And I run past these old cats in the hood. One brother's looked up. He's been drinking Ripple on that same corner for like 90 years. And the guy looks up and he sees me running and he goes, Sweetback's back! He came back. The brother came back just like he said he came back. It was surreal. We went to the very same places my dad went in the ghetto because he was avoiding the unions, and in the desert because the unions couldn't find him and they were scared to go in the hood. And we went to the same locations and did the same stuff. I mean, 33 years later. In fact, we even shot on the very street he lived on, his office was on.
You know how no matter how much you love somebody, they often have like a certain gesture that really gets on your nerves? I'm wondering if your father had something like that that you had to recreate when you were playing him.
Yeah, I did. There are many things. One is he eats with his fingers. And what he does is he says he doesn't want to eat anything. He likes to stay nice and slim. He's got a great stomach. He's, you know, he can still outrun me. He's 71 years old. He's a bad brother. But how he does that is psychologically, he's understood that what he doesn't order won't make him fat. So he encourages you to order something. He gets a mere salad or whatever. And then he'll reach over and put his fingers right into your food and sort of smack it up. The second thing is he chews these big-ass nasty cigars. And I thought, man, I've gone my whole life without getting addicted to any sort of nicotine. I don't drink coffee. And what am I going to do if I do Badass and I have to chew those nasty cigars and I get addicted? That would be a terrible thing. So I had them make me chamomile cigars. And so that's how I did it. So I had to chew these nasty cigars. And after a while, I got used to it. I was like, okay, this is an oral fixation I don't need. But there were a lot of things. Just the way my dad looks when he's about to explode, there's a quietness that's right before the storm when he's looking you right in his eyes and your eyes, and you know you better get out of there quick. And I know I have that same kind of temper. There are things that I was able to do that I realized, well, I'm playing my dad, but then I was, wait a minute, this is not far from me.
I understand why your father had such a hard time raising money for Sweet Sweet Back. It was ahead of its time, you know, politically and racially. But why did you have trouble making money for your film? I mean, raising money for your film.
Yeah, well, this is a good question. Well, you know, Badass, unlike a lot of just American films, doesn't fall into the category so easily as to whether it's a comedy or a drama. And, you know, it's got, and a lot of the notes we sent out when we sent it around to the studios said that. They said, the first studio basically said, look, we think that Badass is going to appeal to the festival crowd. And they were pretty clear about it. And they said, mostly, if you have complex characters, it's better to do those characters white because the audience finds them better. Now, what do I mean by that? You won't see you don't often see a movie like A Beautiful Mind with people of color. You don't see Lost in Translation with people of color. You don't see Good Will Hunting with people of color. So they sort of encouraged me to say, can you make this film more like a Boogie Nights and do it with white folks? And I said, well, that's part of the crew, but it's not the whole story. And every studio said, you got to make Melvin Van Peebles more likable. We're not going to like him in Badass. And I said, but, you know, this is who the guy is. And the one directive I got was that I didn't have to make him too nice, that I could play him as he was. And I, in fact, I had no intention of playing him initially. So when that came back and I realized, okay, I'm not going to get the money to do this thing the big way, I'm going to have to do it the old-fashioned way. I made New Jack City in 40 days, or 36 days, Panther and Posse in about 47 days. I had to make Badass in 18 days, not unlike my dad, who, without the benefits of digital technology, made Sweetback in 19 days.
Mario Van Peebles wrote, directed, and stars in the new film Badass. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Easter Island, a novel of two women on parallel quests, decades apart, and the remote island that connects their stories, by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, creating New Jack Cops for New Jack City. We talk with Mario Van Peebles about his films and growing up in a biracial family. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Spider-Man 2.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mario Van Peebles. He wrote and directed the new film Badass about the making of Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, the 1971 low-budget action film whose success led the way for black action films like Shaft and Superfly. Sweetback was written and directed by Mario's father, Melvin Van Peebles, who also starred in it. Mario plays his father in Badass. Now, your father's film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, was dedicated to, quote, all of the black brothers and sisters who have had enough of the man. What did the man mean to you when you were 12?
The man! What did the man? You got to say it the right way, Terry. You can't say, what did the man mean to you, Terry? You got to say it the right way. Throw a little bonics, baby. What did the man mean to you? Okay. What the man
was.
Thank you
for the line reading.
There you go. The man was the oppressor. You know, it's like when they asked the Panthers, you know, are you racist? And the Panthers said, no, you can't fight oppression with oppression. You can't fight racism with racism. We're anti-oppression. We're anti, subtextually, the man. The man is the oppressor, the Uncle Charlie, the guy pulling the strings. The man is the one that benefits from the war. The man is the one that sends us to die for oil. The man is the one that's saying, you can't do it. The man is the status quo. Did I understand that at 12? Probably not. I think I got some concept of it, but because I think also the man is not necessarily racial, and that the man is not necessarily white, you know, per se, or black, and the crew was multiracial, so that those lines were pretty blurred as a kid. And my family's multiracial, so the I don't know that I understood the concept, but the man is still alive and well in 2004. Believe me, I know, because I couldn't get my funding from him. But when I direct Revenge of the Ninja Bimbos meets Charlie's Angels 4, once again, I'll be working for the man.
The man is going to want to fund that one.
that one they'll want to fund.
No, your mother's white, as you mentioned.
I can use my mother as a reflector board. I sit her in my lap, across my lap, and I can get a, you know, nice tan under my chin.
How did you feel about the whole like black power era, which, you know, your father was part of, you could have been part of it, she would not have been part of it.
How did I feel?
Well, the how did she feel about it? How did she feel about it? And I'm wondering if it divided you from each other at all.
Well, first of all, you have to understand, go back to my sort of radical Adams family-ish family myself.
Yeah. Okay.
My mother's mother, very hip lady, white lady, obviously, sued the school system in Virginia because her kids were not being allowed to go to school with Latino kids, black kids, and Jewish kids, and saying that in doing so, the school system was denying them a full cultural perspective to their education. They won the case. So the KKK burnt a cross on my white grandmother's lawn and called her up and said, we hope your daughters marry niggers. And my grandmother said, thank you, so do we. So I have radical white folks. My grandfather, my mother's father, taught at Harvard and Yale, was German, left Hitler's Germany, thought Hitler was a nut, left Germany and started working for Truman and went to war to fight against the Nazis. And so on my other side, on my black side, my black grandfather taught himself to read. I remember my granddad was one of those readings. My black granddad was one of those readers that, you know, whispers when he reads. You know, so the Bible comes out. You know?
Yeah, I got it.
Because he learned to read when he was 14 years old. Became a landowner and took my dad against my dad's mother's wishes with him to the local grocery store, pulled off all the Wonder Bread on the shelves and stomped on it in the store. And the guy said, what the hell are you doing? And my granddad said, look, Wonder Bread has refused to hire drivers of color, even in black neighborhoods. And until they do, they're not going to sell another loaf of bread in any of these stores. And my granddad and his friends broke the union. So my dad early on started to see that one person could make a difference. And that sort of led to him making a difference. And whatever business you're in, you can make a difference. So I had radical doers, activists on both sides, and they were pretty cool. Actually, it was my black grandmother that was more uptight about anything. I'm told that since I was born in Mexico and they for some reason decided to name me Mario, my family has an M fixation. We're all M's. My sister's Megan and I'm Mario. Anyway, I'm born in Mexico. My dad always gets a kick out of telling me that since mom was there and she's blonde and he's black, that the Mexicans all lined up to see what I would look like, to see if I'd be striped or polka dotted or checkered. And when I looked like your average Mexican kid, they all went, oh. that was it. No, you know, what happened was, I think, you know, as we've seen, the Black Power movement led the way for the women's movement and for the gay movement, that it was not Black Power at the expense of any other power. It was the Black Panthers, who were portrayed as hostile and anti-white, often had big white support.
Your parents separated when you were about three, and you live with your mother. Did your mother and your father expose you to different parts of the counterculture of the period?
Absolutely. Mom knew the drummer in the Grateful Dead. She was the I'm with the band mom. She took us surfing, and she'd smoke her little pot and listen to her rock and roll, and took me to the Fillmore West, where I would hear Janis Joplin and Jefferson Airplane and Santana and Hendrix all on one set. Now, today they'd be fragmented into Latino radio or soul or, you know, but then it was all speaking to the politics of the time. And then I hung out with my dad, and he knew some of the Panthers and, you know, people that were making changes on the Black Power front. He knew Bill Cosby. He took me to Cosby's house. I remember swimming at Cosby's house and thinking, man, one day I want to have a pool like this. To this day, I don't. My pool is a glorified bathtub. And, you know, but just seeing a whole different life. So they exposed us to a lot. We went to Morocco. We went to France. I speak a little French. And like most black folks, I'm bilingual. I can speak a little Ebonics, and I can speak to, you know, I can be on the Terry Gross show. But what I think is interesting, what they did do and what my dad did do, which is very important, was show me that you could know who you were, keep your roots, and yet make real differences in this country.
Now, the first film you directed was New Jack City in 90 or 91. And the cops were the good guys in that movie. You know, their job in that movie was to get a drug dealer who was really dangerous to the community. It's a real kind of change from your father's film, in which, you know, the cops are clearly the man.
Right, that's correct. And what I wanted in New Jack City was, when I got the script, it read like a black Scarface. But I thought, you know, crack is a killer in the black community to this day. And although we don't grow poppy fields, we don't have gun manufacturing plants in the hood, these things seem to find themselves in massive quantities on a daily basis into the poor communities. And so I thought, I wanted to change the structure from being sort of a black Scarface to more sort of an Untouchables, in that Untouchables, the De Niro character, was still the powerful, sort of sexy, empowered gangster. But against Sean Connery and Andy Garcia and Kevin Costner, if you wanted folks to say no to the crack phenomenon, no to the negative side, you had to have something positive or positive role models to say yes to. So I had a New Jack gangster. I needed New Jack cops. Now, it wasn't so much that the cops in Sweetback were the bad guys alone. They were, but it didn't mean that all cops were bad, and it didn't mean that all white people were bad, because remember, at the end of Sweetback, it's the white guy that helps Sweetback escape by changing clothes with him. And I understood that. And what was interesting about in New Jack City, I also understood that at action films, to this day, but really then, in 1991 when I made New Jack, they play the black guy as the police commissioner. He's usually got a receding hairline and a big belly, and he says, "Bring it in by the book, or I'm gonna have your ass." Now, you've seen every black actor, fine black actors, play that role. And so what they're doing is, what Hollywood's doing is a little trick. See, they say, well, we're not racist because we're putting the black guy in a position of power, in a position of authority, but he's not sexy. He's not on the front line. He doesn't have his shirt unbuttoned. He's not going to get the girl. He's not going to shoot his gun. That's where you want to be in an action movie. You don't want to be in the damn police commissioner's office. But that's the role we get. So the other producers came to me who were black guys. And now we had the power with our little $9 million, $8 million film, whatever. And they said, let's flip it. What if we flipped it and we put the white guy in as the police commissioner, and we had him say to the black cop, bring it in all by the book, or I'll have your tail. And we laughed, and I went home. I thought about it. I came back the next day, and I said, you know what? That's doing onto them cinematically as they've done onto us. I'm not going to do that. Let's get, you know, for our New Jack cops, let's get Russell Wong, who's this great-looking, very, you know, distinguished Asian cat, Let's get Judd Nelson, who's Jewish, and let's get Ice-T, and they'll be our new Jack cops. And you know what? I played the police commissioner, and I was the one that wound up saying, bring it in by the book, I'll, the famous line. But so what I wanted to do was there was that there were a lot of, you know, a lot of the establishment, not just a few, but a lot of the establishment understands that the drugs, what the drugs did was medicate the inner cities. When you're medicated, you don't vote. You don't get involved. You don't, you know, and so it medicated the militancy of the late 60s and 70s. They couldn't figure out how to stop that militancy. So when you're on drug, you're cracked out. And so to some extent, there are cops who look at the hoods, the ghettos, as a self-cleaning oven. So why bother? As long as they're shooting themselves and they're getting high, you can see it, Terry, you can see it in Detroit, you can see it in Philly, you can get drugs in Chicago, in L.A. There's always that inner city where they bring the drugs too, and they let these people medicate and shoot each other. And I wanted to show that. So these cops were the exception. These were the, well, not the exception. There are a lot of great cops, and I played many a cop in my career, but I wanted these cops to be New Jack cops. So it was a different spin on what my dad did, but I think in its own way, very relevant.
My guest is screenwriter, director, and actor Mario Van Peebles. Here's a scene from New Jack City. Mario Van Peebles is a cop trying to recruit an ex-cop played by Ice-T. Ice-T is resisting the idea of joining this new undercover team. He's always preferred to work alone.
I've been authorized to set up an independent drug-fighting unit, and I'm picking you. Got it?
Why me?
Why you, man? You from the neighborhood? I can trust you. And I know you give a
So what's the catch?
There's no catch, man. Why you gotta say that?
Because I know your ass, Stone.
Freddy here goes with you.
This big biscuit head looking...
Hey, listen up, Scotty. It's not gonna be another one of your wild-ass solo acts, man. Now, Freddy is the only cop I could find crazy enough to even team up with you. This is my shot. And you up. It's all on me.
I want to thank you a lot, man. Because you know I want to get back in this war. But this guy, man.
So you in or out?
I'm in, man, all right?
We'll talk more with Mario Van Peebles after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is screenwriter, director, and actor Mario Van Peebles. In his new film, Badass, he stars as his father, actor, writer, and director Melvin Van Peebles. Badass is about the making of Melvin's 1971 movie, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Okay, so tell me this. You know, you come of age, like your mother's kind of sounds like really quite the hippie, really. Your father's like into like the Black Power movement and multiculturalism. They're both real independent thinkers, and it sounds like they're both... non-materialistic. It's about larger issues and
right,
ethics
absolutely.
And the movement and all that stuff. And then you make your first film in around in the early 90s, New Jack City, and your main audience, I mean, not main, you had quite a big audience, but I mean a lot of the most excited audience for that film is you know, people in hip-hop culture. And I think it's fair to say hip-hop culture is in a lot of ways a real materialistic culture.
Absolutely, and it's like capitalism on crack. I mean, not only am I have gold in my wallet, and gold in my ring, I'm have gold on my teeth. I want gold everywhere. But that's what poor folks do when they've been convinced that it's not about who you are; it's about what you have, and you got to decolonize that mind. And so the hero, when you look at Ice-T's apartment, just subtextually, Ice-T's apartment had books in it and sunlight. And pictures of thinkers, of intellectuals, Garvey and Malcolm and Maya Angelou. And Nino Brown's place, the gangster, had gold and dead stuff. There was no life, no plants, no sunlight. So even subtextually, I'm saying something with that and about that. And what was cool about it, I mean, when we went to screen Badass in D.C., this one kid stood up and said, I love Badass, but I want to also thank you for New Jack City. Because after I saw New Jack City, I didn't want to touch drugs at all. That was the goal, was to reach beyond the choir and reach those kids that go to see those movies and say, how can I get a message to them, you know? And so you got to figure out what you want to say and then how to hide it. And so buried in there in New Jack City and all the glamour and all that stuff is a very heavy anti-drug message. It's also a very heavy, in a way, if you look at the cops from Ice-T to Judd Nelson to Russell, a non-materialistic message. But these are all other things that you feel. You can't be didactic about it.
I always found it interesting that you cast Ice-T as one of the undercover cops because, you know, he was famous as being, you know, like the prototype of the gangster rapper. He had some records that were very anti-cop, very angry at cops, not kind of making distinctions between good cops and bad cops. And so now he's playing an undercover cop, and an actor has to have some empathy for their character. And I was wondering if that changed him in any way. What do you think?
Well, I think you have to understand, again, his position. And that is, when I went to Ice-T's concert...
I should mention he went on to play a cop all the time in Law & Order.
Right. Ice-T initially wanted to play the gangster, too, and Wesley was going to play the cop, and I wanted them to flip it. And
they did. Mm-hmm.
But Ice-T, when I went to his concert, had this thing where he would say, all right, everyone up in here who's a drug dealer, gangster, raise your hand. So a lot of the kids think it's real cool, so they all raise their hand. He said, all right, everyone of you with your hands up, if you've never been shot at, put your hands down. If you've been shot at, put your hands down. So they put their hands down. If you know anyone who's lived to be over 40 being a drug dealer, you know, keep your hands up. If you don't, put your hands down. More hands go down. If you know anyone who's done what you're doing and never been in jail, you know, put your hands down. More hands. By the end, there's no hands up. And he said, that's right. So F the drug dealer. I can't say it on the air, but that's right. So when you saw that he came at it through a whole cool way and said, the drug dealer is poisoning you. The drug dealer is not to be admired. He came at it as a peer, having a cool stance. You see, what happened was that, you know, the hip hoppers of today inherited the bravado of the Black Panther movement, the Panthers, the Malcolms, the bravado of the Melvin Van Peebles is the stance without the political ideology to substantiate it.
Well, here's something. Here's something else I'm wondering,
too. This is a generation of voluntary slaves that are saying, well, if I learn to speak English, I'm trying to be white. No, you got to learn how to speak English to get a job. You know, it's like what Cosby was saying. You've got to be bilingual. I'm not suggesting. Well, that was cool. That's what I'm saying. Growing up with my dad was like growing up if you're a woman and you grew up with Margaret Thatcher as your mother, whether you agree with mommy's politics or not, whether you agree with her politics, it would be very hard for men to convince you that a woman could have no place in the old boy network of politics. Growing up with my dad, who did speak French, who did speak Dutch, who was one of the first Black officers in the Air Force, was never on drugs, was never in jail, didn't play basketball, and didn't rap, was liberating because I thought it's all possible. And that was the biggest gift, was that I saw the possibilities of what one could do.
Well, Mario Van Peebles, thank you so much for talking with us.
I love talking with you and would, you know, do it anytime. Green eggs and ham, anywhere, on a boat, on a moat, in Philly, wherever.
Mario Van Peebles wrote, directed, and stars in the new film Badass. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Spider-Man 2. This is Fresh Air. The much-anticipated sequel to Spider-Man opened this week. Directed again by Sam Raimi, Spider-Man 2 continues the story of Peter Parker, bitten by a mutant spider and transformed into a soaring, web-spinning superhero. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
A lot of us have trouble reconciling our jobs and our personal lives, but it's particularly rough if you happen to be a masked superhero. First, there's that business about never being in the same place at the same time. That's hard. Then there's that old Pirandello conundrum. Is Bruce Wayne pretending to be Batman, or is it Batman pretending to be Bruce Wayne? Some superheroes never get it straight. At least Bruce has big bucks, which means his butler can run interference. Peter Parker, on the other hand, is desperately poor. He's lovelorn, and he's almost friendless. And when he pulls on that stretchy Spider-Man suit, the tabloids make him out to be the bad guy. This kid is so mixed up, it's no wonder neither side of him, human or superheroic, functions right. All these themes were laid out in the original Spider-Man of 2002, but they're front and center in the sequel, titled Spider-Man 2. The first one was pretty good. This one's terrific. The director, Sam Raimi again, seems more in control of the disparate elements. The effects are woven more tightly into the human drama. The bad guy is cooler, and the love story is a few notches up from adolescent infatuation. But it's the tone that's really striking. It's dark, tortured, intimate, impassioned. It's a comic book spectacle in which the primary struggle happens behind the mask. How dark is dark? Well, the first 90 minutes are a big downer, what with Peter, played again by Tobey Maguire, never catching a break. His romance with the actress MJ, played by Kirsten Dunst, has fizzled, and neither knows what to do. His best friend Harry, played by James Franco, has sworn vengeance against Spider-Man. He begs to keep a pizza delivery boy job, but loses it for not being speedy enough. And things are no happier on the superhero front. In the first film, his discovery that his body could suddenly shoot white webby stuff was scary, but also exciting. Now he discovers that once in a while, when there's too much on his mind, that webby stuff won't jet out. There's more at stake than male self-esteem. A couple of 30-story plunges to the street are enough to give even the most Olympian superheroic athlete performance anxiety. The movie's villain, Dr. Otto Octavius, is another overgrown adolescent. He's played by the great Alfred Molina, a baby bull of a man, kind of dainty and soulful, but apt to get steamed when things don't go his way. After achieving nuclear fusion in his lab, he ends up in the thrall of four giant nano-chip-driven tentacles that bash through walls and hiss in his ear like the aliens in Aliens. There's an odd disjunction that fits with the movie's theme. In the middle of those waving tentacles is a real guy with a beer belly hanging out. Doc Ock might be a joke if Raimi weren't so good at scaring the wits out of you.
Peter Parker.
What do you want?
I want you to find your friend, Spider-Man. Tell him to meet me at the West Side Tower at 3 o'clock.
Well, I don't know where he is.
Find him. Or I'll peel the flesh off her bones.
That's the cue for Spider-Man to be Spider-Man again, and it's not a letdown. Well, there's still only a tenuous link between Tobey Maguire and that digitized computer game little guy that hurtles along those computer-generated avenues. But if the action is unreal, it's also rock'em sock'em. It spins your head, it blasts your ears, it totally envelops you. It's the closest thing to a virtual reality comic book you can get without a helmet. The climax isn't the big battle, though. It's Spidey and MJ, high above the city, having their moment at last. It's hard to overpraise Maguire here, that light, gentle, slightly hoarse voice with just a touch of femininity. It's no wonder that almost every woman alive wants to eat him up. Can this sweet kid reconcile himself to his inner superhero? And can the movie finally get beyond the Sturm und Drang? I'll tell you only that Spidey's final swing is like a Gene Kelly happy dance. Spider-Man 2 has an ecstatic emotional arc. For all the computer simulations, the movie breathes.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by singer and guitarist Jackie Paris. He died in June at the age of 79 of bone cancer. He recorded with Charles Mingus. Lenny Bruce was a fan. He was the first to sing the lyrics to Round Midnight. This is from Jackie Paris's final album, The Intimate Jackie Paris, which was recorded in 1999.
Love is funny. Or it's sad, or it's quiet, or it's mad. It's a good thing, or it's bad. But beautiful to take a chance, and if you fall, you fall, and I'm certain I wouldn't mind at all. Love is tearful, or it's gay. It's a problem, or it's play. It's a heartache either way, but beautiful, and I'm thinking if you never let you go. And that would be but beautiful, I know. Love is tearful, it's gay.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We gotta get out of this place.
The British invasion band Eric Burdon and the Animals had such hits as We Gotta Get Out of This Place, Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, and House of the Rising Sun. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Burdon. He has a new CD called My Secret Life. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty.